City Limits is a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media, and is funded by generous grant support from the Central New York Community Foundation, Grossman St. Amour CPAs, National Grid, and listeners like you. To support the project, visit the City Limits About page at citylimitsproject.org.
41,000 Syracuse residents were below the poverty line in 2016.
At its core, poverty is about pushing down instead of having an opportunity to go up.
It's, generally speaking, lack of access to opportunity.
This is City Limits, a poverty project.
Welcome to City Limits Talk, part of WAER's City Limits Project to examine Syracuse's poverty rate and what's being done to address it. I'm WAER News Director Chris Bolt. Today we're pleased to have a conversation with Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh to learn more about his perspectives on poverty, how it's hampering the city's efforts to progress, as well as ideas and initiatives that might help. Thanks for being here, Mr. Mayor.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Chris.
We're also joined by Deputy Mayor Sharon Owens, who has dealt with the effects of poverty in City Hall and in the neighborhoods before. Welcome, Sharon.
Great to be here.
Sam Edelstein is here, the Chief Data Officer of the city.
Thanks for having me.
And Community and Business Development Commissioner Stephanie Pasquale is joining us. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Also, today's conversation is joined by WAER reporter and host Katie Zilkowski, another of the contributors to our City Limits Project. Glad to have you joining in as well.
Thank you, Chris.
And you can hear all of the podcasts on various issues surrounding poverty, as well as past City Limits Talk panel discussions on how poverty is entwined with education and the criminal justice system, on our special website, citylimitsproject.org. Our reporting during City Limits covered some of the barriers to getting out of poverty, as well as different programs that are helping. And we'll get to some of those specific areas a little later in this program. We'll also present a few questions sent in via social media on the issue. But to start out, Mayor Walsh, you've done a good deal of talking about this issue in some of the public appearances and presentations you've made recently, including your State of the City address. Another example is you were talking to the CNY Regional Planning and Development Board a little while ago that I attended. You had a strong message about how poverty threatens to get in the way of what otherwise would be very positive developments for the city. Just how much do you think poverty is holding us back?
Well, it most certainly is. And I often turn to our vision that we established at the beginning of our administration. Our vision is for Syracuse to be a growing city that embraces diversity and creates opportunity for all. And it's really that last part that, frankly, I've evolved on. I spent 6 years as the city's economic development director and was very proud and am very proud of our accomplishments. But I think it really hit home for me going door to door during the campaign and talking with residents in the city that while they acknowledged that good things were happening and investments were being made, all too often they didn't feel any direct connection or benefit from those investments. So it's the question for me is, how do we continue that momentum, that investment in our community, but ensure that when it happens, it benefits more of our community?
And, I mean, I don't know if this is quantifiable, but in what ways does poverty cost the city? There's the very obvious of lower income means people just have less money to do things. But in what other ways do you find that, you know, non-participation in the economy, for example, or other ways where developers might or might not do things, is it affecting the city?
Well, there's nothing more frustrating to me than to, in a matter of a couple meetings, could be within the same day, I'm talking with community members and residents who are telling me that they can't find employment, they can't find jobs. And then in the next meeting, I'm with a bunch of employers that talk about all the jobs that they can't fill. There's this inherent misalignment in the skills that our residents have or don't have and those that our employers are looking for. So, while we certainly want to see more businesses grow and invest, the fact is there are many that are doing that now. And what's holding them back are those barriers that are keeping people in poverty.
One of the things that came up in your State of the City address is the Syracuse surge. What kind of impact can that have?
Well, for us, it ultimately that strategy is rooted in our poverty issue. So if you step back a little bit, earlier in the administration, the census data was released back in September, the most recent census data, And once again, we found ourselves on in the wrong kind of top 10 list, ninth most impoverished city. Mm-hmm. And of course, you with your initiative have been focused on many of these issues. But as we when we saw that, you know, rather than kind of throw our hands up, we did what we try to do every time we encounter a challenge. We looked at the data. So I challenged Sam and his team in the Office of Accountability, Performance, and Innovation, and Stephanie and her team in Neighborhood and Business Development to really dig into the data and try to understand where we have the most significant barriers, especially when compared to our other peer communities, because certain things are out of our control, global macroeconomic forces. But when all other things are equal, what are those barriers? And when you look at SURGE, and we'll talk more about it, the specific initiatives identified within SURGE are intended to directly align to address those barriers that we identified through that process.
Stephanie, is it your job to sort of figure out what are those initiatives in neighborhood and business development that, you know, aren't at the 30,000-foot level but are down doing things with individual families?
Sure. And at the neighborhood and parcel level, looking at investment strategies that won't just affect that one property or that one household, but will have ripple effects and leverage other dollars and private investment in a neighborhood. So we often seed projects, whether it's affordable housing development, if it's promoting home ownership or removing blight, that we hope make, you know, serves as that seed to see other private investment grow. We know we can't do this with government funds alone. And we've seen some positive results from that work.
I'd just like to know, I mean, talking about housing and things like that, the iTeam I did see had just launched the TOP program. Was that what it is, the pilot program, about a year ago? And it was mentioned in the State of the City address as well. So is that still looking at the beginning of February for launch? And how have you seen that change in the North Side, which was the test community?
Sure. So this was a great partnership with the Department of Neighborhood and Business Development and our codes department. We knew that the code violations were largely brought in by complaints. And so what we thought was that there was a way to have data sort of lead our way towards the way that we deploy operations. So looking at where there were parts of the city that were most likely to have a code violation, as well as focusing on places where historically there had been code violations, deploying specific code inspectors to go out, have ownership over a certain part of the city rather than a broader sort of anywhere in the city or a quadrant by quadrant basis, then they could go and get to know the community better. And so we saw a lot more proactive code violations happening, so that it meant that it wasn't just based on people who were complaining. It was making sure that people more broadly had the kind of service that they needed from the city, as well as just better conversations between the code inspectors and landlords, as well as tenants, so that everybody understood where what the rules are, where they can get service. So actually, it meant that sometimes we weren't issuing code violations that we might have otherwise, because we could have a conversation up front rather than after the fact. And so a landlord might fix the property before there even needed to be escalated to a violation itself.
So I guess I could use that to pivot back to the Syracuse SURGE initiative, where that seems to be very community focused, using data to interact with the community and not just placing the numbers on the community. So how will Syracuse SURGE sort of take the same approach of the data that you have collected to make sure that the community you're building in is receiving the advantages of these economic developments?
Sharon, do you want to touch on that?
Yes, we've talked about in Syracuse SURGE how our community prospered under the first and second industrial revolutions, and it was during the computer age when Silicon Valley was thriving that our community really did not keep pace. And part of that reason is that we had workforces that needed to transition from more of the warehouse and industrial kind of workforce. And I think that our community did a really good job in workforce kind of pivoting for people who had jobs. The problem was that we did not keep pace with individuals who had not even cracked that former industrial ceiling and really left people behind. And what we are absolutely focused, laser focused on, is making sure that through our partnerships, we are creating training opportunities and job opportunities and preparing people for what this means to us. Now, the tricky part is that, you know, this is so exciting. None of us absolutely know what this means and what is going to be potentially coming for us and at us, and it's all great. And what we're looking for and hoping is that the industry is going to tell us, but we have to be ready and in position to be fluid enough to have our people trained.
And so part of the census was that lack of access to internet at home. Is Syracuse Surge sort of related to that in some ways to increase digital literacy and take down the digital divide in Syracuse?
Yeah, so I'll jump back in there. In many ways, that Surge, the foundation of Surge, is found within our initiative to acquire and upgrade our streetlight network. So we have almost 18,000 streetlights. We're in the process of acquiring them from National Grid. And the first thing we're going to do is retrofit all the lights to LED technology, and in doing so, save significant resources on both energy and operations and maintenance. But what is even more exciting is the partnership that we have with the New York Power Authority, which is going to allow us to essentially affix what we describe as smart nodes on each of the streetlights, which will create a level of connectivity that, while not initially will be public Wi-Fi level, will create what's called a low-powered wide area network, essentially connecting all of our streetlights throughout the city, which will enable us through additional partnerships to potentially pilot public Wi-Fi and begin to bridge that digital divide in all of our neighborhoods. And the key for us as we deploy that technology is how can we ensure, again, that we're doing it in an equitable way that ensures that every neighborhood is going to have the same opportunity. So there is a direct connection between that investment that we're making as the city, not one that we're going out and asking others to make it ourselves. The Common Council is authorized a bond issuance of $38 million to make this investment. But this is the type of technology infrastructure investment that's critical to compete in the new economy. So we're excited about it, and it really did become kind of the launch pad for all the other initiatives within Surge.
That smart city, your smart grid city, this is going on in other places, right? I mean, is there a city or an example that you look to that says, well, they did it, you know, some time ago and now are starting to sort of add on the benefits of that?
Yeah, and, you know, Sam can speak to it better than I, but I will say that there are other communities doing it. Smart city technology, and the term smart cities is not new, and in many ways we're already deploying some of those technologies, at the point that we fully deploy our streetlight network with those smart nodes, we will be the largest connected city in the entire country. So, again, Sharon made that point about the context of industrial revolutions and how we grew in the first and second and then regressed in the third. We're putting all of this within the context of what's increasingly being described as the fourth industrial revolution that we're in right now, which is all based on connectivity. The Internet of Things is another term that you hear. And so understanding that much of what is going to drive the new economy is that connectivity, the fact that we will be able to plant our flag in Syracuse and say we are the most connected city in the entire country really allows us, pardon the phrase, to surge forward and not only compete with our peer communities, but get out ahead of them.
I mean, is there a benefit there both to be attractive for a business to move in, millennials to move in? And we've actually rated pretty well in some cases about a city where millennials might want to either come to or stay, but also getting at this thing we're talking about, that those who are left behind. Like, you could see those divides almost as a connected gentrification of everybody above one line is doing great. And in fact, it's great in many ways, yet it's still not reaching down or back or whatever term you want to use to those who could use it most and need to get ahead the most.
I think one of the most exciting things about this is then on the very high-level conversations we have with individuals in various business areas, while we're all learning how to get our hands around what this potential really evolves into, when you talk to individuals in different industries, their eyes glaze over in excitement about the potential. And so it is extremely exciting and extremely also kind of scary at the same time, because we have to be ahead of what is coming to us and preparing individuals and understanding data and understanding the responsibility that comes along with collecting data as well.
Sure, because those are the numbers that really mean did anything work. You can have the programs, sort of a classic, you can do programs that address problems, but what's the outcome? Are you really getting the outcome that's needed?
Right.
This is City Limits Talk on WAER Syracuse. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, are there effective ways to help those in poverty get ahead, be more competitive, or get ready for a job? Stay with us.
As long as poverty remains an issue in central New York, WAER will continue to bring you coverage. The City Limits Project now has 35 episodes for you to explore.
We do know that poverty is a major problem in disability communities.
There's only so much money to go around when you're working a minimum wage job.
Because of so many different socioeconomic factors, they start life behind the eight ball.
Hear more at citylimitsproject.org.
From day one, you walk into our room, we are going to allow anyone to join our program that has a desire to work. So immediately, we're able to build a relationship that says, no matter who you are, we are going to support you through this.
Welcome back to City Limits Talk as we sit down with Mayor Ben Walsh to discuss poverty in Syracuse and the path forward. We're going to include a question that came in from a listener on social media. Anne from Syracuse is asking, can the city require businesses or developers who get tax breaks to create jobs for the disadvantaged?
The short answer is yes. It's a matter of figuring out how to do it and how to do it in a way that strikes the balance between ensuring that the business that's coming to us for support is viable, but also using that public investment as leverage to ensure the right kind of outcomes and that ultimately the community benefits. So, you know, going back to my time as economic development director, it is about striking that balance. My feeling is if you're a business in the city and you're making an investment and you're using your resources to do it, then, you know, ultimately you can run the business the way that you want to. But when you come to the government and ask for public resources, taxpayer dollars, then yes, we should have a say in how you're using those resources, and we should ensure that that your investments and your business practices align with our priorities. So we have made a number of changes to our policies in recent years to try to better align those priorities, ensuring that people are working to preserve historic properties, that they're developing mixed use and increasingly mixed income properties, and ultimately that they are hiring people located within the area and ideally within the city of Syracuse.
Stephanie, in neighborhood and business development, is this something that's a conversation that either you have to initiate or you're hearing from businesses that as they're developing or creating or expanding, that they do have an interest in essentially helping with poverty, whether that's an entry-level position or a specialized training? I mean, is this part of the conversation that the business community, in many cases, which is doing pretty well, unemployment's super low, there are development projects, that they actually do have an interest in kind of bringing the whole community up, even though it's not necessarily their job to do so?
What's been so exciting over the last year in the new administration has been the degree to which private businesses have been reaching out, the lending community, construction community, to do just that, to say, how can we help and how can we play a better role? And I think as the mayor outlined in the State of the City, talking about Syracuse Build, that's a great example of how large institutions and developers aren't afraid of rolling up their sleeves and chipping in. And it's been really positive and exciting conversations that are occurring every week to advance just that.
We started to talk about economic initiatives that can help alleviate poverty and bring the whole city up. You mentioned Syracuse Build. How can that help get that person who's low skilled or hasn't really been participating in the workforce to jobs that are really out there, you know, that they can participate sort of as a direct line?
So if I may, there are two things that have changed in the workforce development area, many of our partners. One is that we are not going to continue to train people for the sake of training people. Myself and many people around this table and other partners have run into people with stacks of certificates and no employment. So that is counterproductive. It discourages people who get all of this training and still can't find employment. So our partners, in our initial meeting with you all when the Syracuse Educational Opportunity Center was here in Timpanix, and that is exactly what they do with Work Train. It is training for the purpose of an end job. And so we absolutely. The other thing that I, and just to piggyback on what Stephanie said, that I find encouraging is that employers now are really flexible on what they're looking for in an individual. Mm-hmm. They actually rather train the individual on what the job requires. They're looking for us to prepare people on what we always have called the soft skill. Now, many people have thought that soft skills may not have been a productive way of using resources and preparing people for work. But it is, I think, unrealistic to expect people who for generations have not had consistent work as part of their everyday experience to know exactly what the ins and outs of our people working. I learned how to go to work and have a job because I watched my parents work. But when you have your parents and your parents' parents and your aunts and uncles and nobody has a job, I think it is a stretch to innately think that people know how to do that.
Right.
So being able to have those soft skills and prepare people with those innate skills that people assume individuals have is critical. And then the employers are actually wanting us, let us train people on what we actually need them to do.
Are we learning enough to start to nudge things? I mean, I hear some optimism in your voice. Are we learning enough to nudge things in that direction to say, hey, we can make the A to B connection?
We absolutely are, because we're listening to the people we've been training. You know, right. People cannot be in training for 6-7 months. If you were going to be in an educational setting such as that, you would be enrolled in college or somewhere else. Mm-hmm. You're looking for very specific skills that will lead to a job. And the training partners that we have and that have been successful, like EOC and like WorkTrain, understand that.
Right. Yeah, I think what those programs have and what increasingly we're looking to deploy is what we call the dual client model. So it's engaging both the prospective employees and the employers, so you've addressed that gap. And that's what we're seeing working. And going back to the private sector, they know that in order to compete, they need the workforce. So I think in a way that maybe certainly more than they ever have been, they're willing to engage because they understand that they need those partnerships in order to compete.
So someone you mentioned in the private sector in your state of the city was Syracuse University. So how is the partnership with that university, a big partnership it sounds like, tackling isolation and soft skills and working on that dual client model?
Well, for us, Syracuse University is one of the largest employers in the region. They have large-scale construction projects going on every day. So as we started to develop the Syracuse Build model, which is we're being careful not to duplicate any of the existing workforce development programs. It's simply aligning them to the job opportunities that exist. So we can, as the city, put our projects on the table, and the county is a partner as well. But to bring a significant private sector partner and employer to the table to say, yeah, we're willing to work with you, it's significant. And to SU's credit, they have not waited for us. If you look at the projects that they're undertaking now, they have been very progressive in aiming to hire more minorities, more veterans, more local residents. But by partnering with this broader initiative, it allows us to do it, frankly, at a scale that really builds our community's capacity to move that needle, as you said, Chris. The big project, of course, that's looming is 81,
right.
and we see this as an opportunity to really prepare our community for that opportunity and others.
I mean, is that a component of it? We just did a story with the Urban Jobs Task Force, and of course, they're really talking about, hey, can we start training people to do work on 81? It's going to be $2 billion. Is that a component? I mean, is that talked about in the Syracuse Build, the halls of Syracuse Build?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was really what the primary motivating factor. Again, these are not new issues, and we've been working on them in a number of different ways. But I think 81 has given not just the city, but the community an opportunity to really focus and to try to ensure that we are aligned in how we address this, because those opportunities are going to be significant and the likes of which we have not seen in a very long time in this community. And if we do it right, it can put a whole generation on track for employment for a long time to come. So it is a once in a generation opportunity.
Is that enough of a motivation to work on Syracuse poverty to be part of an 81 contractual situation, to have a community benefit agreement, say? I'm not sure that's the right venue or model, maybe it is, so that all of that hiring, all of that work does in fact impact poverty. I mean, it's a transportation project, but as you said, it could be a generation of workers that make more, become the model for their children to, you know, see working parents, et cetera.
It is. It's again, it's something that has already started to bring people to the table. And again, while in the short to midterm, the most obvious opportunities are going to be construction related. We try to remind ourselves that, you know, we need to prepare people for all of the other related opportunities. So, service companies, all sorts of different elements of the economy are going to be impacted by this. So, you know, we've started focused on construction, but the goal is to expand that. So we're providing opportunities in a number of different sectors. But yes, this project is one unlike any other, and it certainly has us focused.
There are success stories going on in the city, you know, downtown businesses, you know, Haler, Fryer & Coon just moved downtown. It just indicates that companies are interested in doing things down there. Needless to say, residency, the number of residents downtown continues to grow. There's construction and various components. How can that expand to do something about poverty, to reach out and use the successes TGC players, another one, continues to hire, has job availabilities all the time? How can those companies or that success or that innovation make a dent? I don't know, Sam, maybe this is in your wheelhouse.
Part of the idea behind Syracuse Surge, I think, is to prepare people for the jobs of the future, and future is in now, really. So making sure that we have residents that are educated in the way that they'll need to be educated to take on the jobs that need to be filled. And so I think that goes from analyzing a lot more data that'll come from things that the city's owning or that a company may want to collect through some of the ways that we're deploying a network here. But also, honestly, there's manufacturing that will be a part of that. There are sensors that will manufacture needs of things that we'll start to understand as things like autonomous vehicles start driving around our streets. There's all sorts of new things that will come that I don't know about that I think, you know, are sort of up in the air and seem like the Jetsons in a lot of ways. But in the next decade, will become a reality here. So setting up the opportunity for there to be education, both for kids who are going to school, but also for people who currently are looking for being able to be retrained, and also acknowledging that there will need to be a large deal of retraining just for people who need new opportunities. I think those are all the places that Surge is trying to hit on and prepare people for.
Chad?
Also, we see downtown and just its growth is phenomenal. Both residency and businesses coming into downtown. We see it as the beating heart of the city, and what we've concentrated on are those arteries leading to that heart, all of those neighborhood-based business corridors that lead right into downtown, and really emphasizing that while Surge is centralized on southern downtown and going into that gateway, southern gateway community, its effects are going to be residual to all of these sides of the city and those business corridors that are heading into downtown. And it is those corridors that run right past the home or the apartment of individuals who may be in and out of poverty or struggling. And so the more we can bring jobs closer to people instead of trying to get people to jobs is one other huge component for us.
And something I'm wondering is that Syracuse does have a little bit of, you could say, a reputation of a talent drain in some ways. While you're obviously making efforts to train the people here, how are you going to get them to stay once they're trained? So is there anything in mind that you're doing to make the city not only more educated and out of poverty, but also get them to stay here once they are?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the area where we're most effective right now at attracting and training, retaining talent, it is downtown. I mean, it's not a coincidence that our largest employers are increasingly looking to downtown and the urban core to locate their business. They are they're in a competition to attract talent, and they know being in a dynamic, vibrant urban area is attractive, particularly to young, talented people. So we have that working in our favor, and we're trying to build upon those trends. But to Sharon's point, and it's something that Stephanie's involved in every day, it's how can we intentionally expand that economic activity into our neighborhoods, into our neighborhood business districts, in a way that those young professionals that may want to live downtown in a studio apartment when they first come to work at a TCG player, the next logical step would be into one of our many great neighborhoods where they can grow their family and their career. So it's again, I think the good news is we have trends working in our favor. Young people, talented people want to be in dynamic urban environments, so we need to continue to double down on what's working in our urban core, but we need to be intentional in how we expand it in a way that benefits the rest of the city.
It also includes ensuring that we are creating a city that also creates opportunities for people when they're not at work. And so for young families, it's important to have a vibrant art scene or nightlife scene. And so we work constantly on making sure that that is as open and diverse as it can be.
Stephanie, what are the ways to get the vibrancy and the successes of the city to start to, I don't know, filter out or to start to spur, down south, 800 South Salina and south and, out past, say, Armory Square, past West Street on the west side?
Well, a couple of things, and I think sometimes it doesn't get enough credit, but the zoning overhaul that's happening right now, Rezone Syracuse,
right,
is actually looking at what's allowed along these corridors and the changes to that zoning ordinance will result in additional investment and just a greater understanding and clarity around where a business can invest and what's allowed there. Additionally, we've just for as an example along South Avenue, we conducted a true sort of grassroots market study that looked at not just what is possible there from a planning and dreaming perspective, but what do the residents really want to see? And as Sharon mentioned, those arteries, those business corridors that we have all over the city, there's lots of mixed use and other opportunities for investment.
Mm-hmm.
And if those are the spines, the ribs are the housing strategy that sort of supports that. So we've been looking at trying to provide incentives for the mixed use buildings. Is there a way that we can help invest in the housing component that makes the first floor viable for commercial redevelopment? So those kinds of programs and creative investment strategies, we're seeing them take hold, and we just need to figure out how to bring those to scale.
If those do get off the ground, those mixed use developments, are the bottom floor businesses really good sort of first jobs for people in those otherwise, right now, these are the impoverished neighborhoods, whether that's along South Ave or, as I said, out west of West Street or South Salina? If you have that mixed use, so there's housing there, which is probably nicer housing, but also retail, do those become a place where people get a first job or enter the economy who aren't in it now?
Absolutely. And I think those are the wonderful conversations that are happening. Mm-hmm. The businesses that are interested are growing right from the neighborhood, and that they often do hire and want to hire right from that area.
Well, and it's how we probably all got our first jobs. You do something right in the neighborhood, and maybe creating more of that does actually help on that local level. This is City Limits Talk on WAER Syracuse 88.3 FM. Coming up, sometimes barriers that have nothing to do with an actual job or paycheck get in the way of trying to climb out of poverty. How might they be overcome to help people and families? Stay with us.
Communicate with companies, and they want to have a diverse workforce. They want that. The diversity is in the city, but they have to be able to get there.
Welcome back to City Limits Talk. We're here with Mayor Ben Walsh, Deputy Mayor Sharon Owens, City Chief Data Officer Sam Edelstein, and Neighborhood and Business Development Commissioner Stephanie Pasquale. We've covered some of the strictly economic aspects of poverty, but what might be done to help? We're going to move into some of the other barriers that make it hard to rise out. But first, another question that came in from social media, this one related to job training, which we were discussing a few minutes ago. Kathy from Syracuse asks, education being key, not all children aspire to attend college. What new training programs or courses might be offered beyond BOCES decades-old courses, 21st century career ready for local markets? I know, Sharon, you started to talk about that, but Mayor, I don't know if you want to tackle that.
Yeah, I'd love to. If you look at what is working the best right now in the Syracuse City School District, where we're seeing the most progress and innovation, a lot of it is focused around our career and technical education programs, our CTE programs. When you look at attendance rates for kids that are involved in CTE programs, they're higher. When you look at the grades, they're higher. And when you look at the high school with the highest concentration of CTE programs, ITC, right downtown, we have the highest graduation rate by far. We're over 90% graduation rate when district-wide we're at about 64%. Those kids, the beauty of these programs is they are still getting their Regents diploma, but they're focusing the rest of their curriculum in areas that they're interested in and that do have real-world job applications. And so if they get through that and they want to continue their education in college, they can. But if they don't, they have skills that make them that much more attractive to the labor market. So, again, getting back to Surge, that's another area where we're really looking to take the next step and build off of what's working. Specifically, Sharon mentioned the SUNY Educational Opportunity Center. We're going to invest in that expanding and growing both physically as well as its programming, but also this concept of a regional STEAM school. That is building off of, again, what's working at ITC. It's incorporating performing arts, which Sharon mentioned is an important part of the equation for having a vibrant community. And it also starts to break down some of the other barriers, the urban-suburban barriers that keep people living in poverty. So, that's an area. Education is key, and we have some pretty exciting initiatives moving forward.
Sharon, draw the connection for us that as that takes hold more and more and more kids go through that, it impacts Syracuse's poverty.
Well, I'll give you a very real example. We are currently both chiefs of fire and police for the public sector, which are very good jobs. They are purposefully looking at PSLA at Fowler for their public service academy curriculum around public safety, and they're intentionally creating programs that they can recruit out of the school young people who are not going to go to college or do not want to go to college, but can have some incredible jobs serving our city, whether it's the fire department or the police department. And we are blessed enough to have two leaders in those two departments who see the value of that school, the value of the curriculum they're developing in preparation of those young people, and want to have a direct line from their graduation right into public service.
Transportation continues to come up as a reason someone can't get to a job, even if they can get one. And a lot of times this is their better job. They get a little job, you know, sort of very, very entry level, maybe part time. Now they have an opportunity to get something a little better, but they can't get there. It's not on a bus line. Is this something you're hearing? And are there ideas that can improve this situation?
Yeah, transportation is a significant barrier. And we are looking at it in a number of different ways. When we talk about far forward, one exciting opportunity that we didn't really think was possible up until we started working on our streetlight initiative was the idea of bus rapid transit, using the technology that we're going to have within our streetlight network that will enable that connectivity that will allow a bus to communicate with the traffic light. That's something, again, long term that we think an opportunity that could open up. But in the short term, I think Sharon brought up a good point. We want to try to bring the jobs to the people as opposed to the other way around, and we see a great opportunity to do that within our neighborhood business districts. And Stephanie and her team are constantly inventorying sites, identifying what are keeping these sites from further redevelopment, whether it's tax delinquency, environmental issues. So it's bringing people to the jobs, but then also continuing to look for ways to enhance those transportation options. The ride-sharing economy has helped, and we're looking at ways to continue to grow alternative transportation options. We're talking with Centro, and they are very much on board with working with us on all this, but the reality is they've had a hard time just balancing the books under current circumstances. So I think it has helped us to focus on working with them to remove some of their challenges to fiscal sustainability before we get too far out of ourselves. But again, with these technology investments, we think some of those opportunities are much more attainable now.
In your below-the-line report, there are some pretty important statistics, I think, about transportation, one being that there is a decline of people using public transit in Syracuse, but the number of people with low income stays stable, and two-thirds of people using public transportation don't have a vehicle at home. So how in the future, I mean, even looking at a BRT situation, how are you planning for that to help the people who use it the most?
Well, I think that's where we have to start. We have to start working with those that are currently relying on public transportation to better understand what their needs are. And again, getting back to that issue of Centro's current constraints, some of the most significant challenges that are faced by those that are using it now are the fact that routes have been cut. So again, it's working on a parallel track to achieve some sort of fiscal sustainability within Centro to allow for them to have the routes in place that address the immediate needs of their users, while also again thinking about the future and how technology can help us to do more than that. But to your point, when we looked at the numbers, it was apparent that not only is a significant part of our population relying on public transportation, but again, when compared with our peer communities, we're behind. So it's really working on a parallel track to address the issues today and tomorrow.
Looking forward with technology, do you see that Syracuse remains a city reliant on cars rather than something that has a more public transportation feel with the population that's using it? I know that the Westcott Remix potential development on Westcott Street is looking at creating a space that's not reliant on cars, but creating a more pedestrian public transportation kind of feel. So is that something that as a city is being looked at?
Absolutely. We are trying to increasingly with our infrastructure investments ensure that we're being more equitable in how we're investing in transportation infrastructure, ensure that public projects and private projects are more pedestrian friendly, ensuring that private development are taking into consideration bike storage as opposed to just parking spaces. Stephanie mentioned Rezone. That's going to give us an opportunity to influence how we account for transportation and specifically cars within development projects and how we might be able to discourage certain types of uses and encourage others. But I think Sam brought up a good point earlier, too. We're trying to force ourselves to think far into the future. And again, getting back to the 81 issue, we need to be planning for the transportation of the future, which is going to look very different than it does today. And so that's why, we've been frustrated with the 81 conversation being solely focused on cars and cars as they operate today, because 50 years from now, it's going to be completely different. And we need to be investing in the transportation infrastructure of the future.
Sam, does the data on who uses or doesn't use public transportation suggest specific things to do, maybe 21st century and beyond?
Well, just from the below-the-line report, what we saw was that people who don't have vehicles largely rely on public transportation. We also, as indicated before, public transportation utilization is going down. And I think generally we can also connect that then to workforce participation, which we saw as being lower in Syracuse than other upstate cities. So potentially people using public transportation less because they can't get to a job and those things sort of touching back and forth. I think to the idea around surge and what the mayor was alluding to before about an expanded network is that by investing in technology networks that will allow for more connectivity for us with our computers and phones, but also for cars as they're connecting and able to get around the city in different ways, it will open up a whole new use of opportunities for being able to get around and not just relying specifically on me owning a car that I can get from point A to point B. The ride sharing of the future may look quite a bit different.
What is the city's role in availability of affordable and safe housing and or improving the existing housing stock to sort of tackle that problem of how often people move?
Yeah, so we've been employing a lot of different strategies, but there's sort of some fundamental truths that we grapple with regarding, you know, over the last several decades with population loss, we used to house a lot more families than we have right now. So we're dealing with older properties that mm-hmm. often have quality issues or investment. There's a gap between what the property is worth and sometimes what investment is needed to fix them. But all that said, there's a lot of investment going on around affordable housing. And as the mayor mentioned, we're trying to encourage mixed income redevelopment so that when folks come to us looking for, whether it's financing from my office or other incentives, that they're incorporating these principles. But additionally, I think a lot of the work we're doing, we talked about the TOP program or with code enforcement, but also with eviction prevention, really trying to keep folks in place when at all possible. So we've been piloting a lot of exciting and impactful programs that are doing just that and getting partners to collaborate differently and better than they have before.
Do people generally realize that just moving, which when you want to move doesn't seem like it's that disruptive, but having to move is really disruptive and it's hard to keep a job?
Moving is always disruptive, whether you want to or not. But absolutely, more than anything, the disruption to children and the routine that they need and depend on is completely torn apart for them, and that impacts their ability to concentrate in school and a wide variety of things. And particularly when we talked about transportation and the ability, and you're on a routine about how you're going to get to work or how you're going to get to the amenities you need to, and then you have to move again, it makes it difficult. I wanted to make one more point around the transportation issue. And in general, as we're looking forward and planning for the future, typically when you're talking about populations who have lagged behind what the norm of us have been doing, there are two pinnacle milestones for people, particularly living in poverty. The first is their ability to acquire a car, because it gives them the independence they need, and they're not dependent on public transportation and when someone else can get me where I need to go. And the other is when I buy a home. So as we look at how we're planning for the future, understanding that for some people, finally being financially able to acquire a car is a huge milestone for them, an important thing to consider as we move forward. Right.
This is City Limits Talk on WAER Syracuse. Coming up, how are perceptions of poverty in Syracuse affecting the city and our ability to improve the situation? Stay with us.
As long as poverty remains an issue in Central New York, WAER will continue to bring you coverage. The City Limits Project now has 35 episodes for you to explore.
We do know that poverty is a major problem in disability communities.
There's only so much money to go around when you're working a minimum wage job.
Because of so many different socioeconomic factors, they start life behind the eight ball.
Hear more at citylimitsproject.org.
The most important thing besides just feeding is change the mindset of the community, making people understand that the person that you see that's homeless is just like you. But when you start changing the minds of the people, then real change happens.
Welcome back to City Limits Talk. We have one more question from the audience I'd like to get in now. Ty from Syracuse asks, what ideas are being discussed to prevent gentrification of the near South Side when the Syracuse Surge goes into full effect?
Great question, and it's something that we spend a lot of time talking about internally. Stephanie mentioned how we're focused on mixed income opportunities, but it also goes back, I think, to our earlier conversation that Sharon touched on, how we're engaging with the community and being honest with the community. There's been a lot of talk recently about when 81 was first built and the impact on the 15th Ward. As we look into the future, again, whether it's 81, whether it's Surge, whether it's what the Syracuse Housing Authority is planning with their properties, change is coming. And I think that it's incumbent upon all of us in the public sector, private sector, in the neighborhoods to be honest with each other about what that change entails and how we can be intentional in ensuring that that change is equitable and that ultimately we don't result in gentrification, which is kind of the default what that happens in communities when property values start to go up. So it starts with community engagement, having honest conversations with neighborhoods, understanding that concentrated poverty and concentrating low-income housing units in one particular place may not be the best approach. But if we're talking about increasing mixed income, then we need to make sure that those that that are living in Section 8 housing, for example, do have places to live. And oftentimes that's as a community, when you look at our history, we've all gone into these significant opportunities, saying the right things, but then in the implementation, often inevitably, and again, we're not unique in Syracuse, it's those that are living in poverty, that are living in these affordable units that end up on the losing end.
One of the things that gets a lot of discussion and is underway, though not funded, I understand, is the HOPE Initiative. How much can that do, and what's the city's role vis-a-vis the various programs that HOPE will eventually finance and initiate, et cetera?
So HOPE is an opportunity. I equate it to what we've just done with the sidewalk plowing. For years, we've been talking about, you know, ways to address it. And then we finally said, let's try something. And so HOPE is our way of looking at the whole complexity that you all have been talking about over this past year, and to begin to look at certain pilot initiatives that will go look at transportation to workforce development, a variety of initiatives, to see really the state was saying in these 15-some-odd communities, let's see how you approach it, and let's take a look statewide which initiatives are going to get us the best results that we can help move people in the pendulum. And so HOPE is launching to do that, going through bureaucracy at the state level, take some time, so that's where we are now. But I think we're going to move forward, and I'm just at the point where can we try something? Can we try some initiatives? And sometimes when you don't succeeded something, you learned what not to do again. And so I'm prepared, and we're prepared as a community to not just sit and twiddle our thumbs and say it's a huge block that we, you know, have to move the entire thing. No, you can chip away at it.
I got the chance to talk with OSHA for the City Limits Project at the end of the year, and she was expanding on some of her HOPE initiatives but couldn't give me great detail because of the state limitations. But the Financial Literacy Center that you guys are doing as a city is something that she had mentioned in vague concept to me. That's a pretty unique program and something that is often overlooked. So how is that important in the role of impoverished communities in the city?
I'm so glad you brought that up. So the Financial Empowerment Center will launch on or about April 1st, and we are fortunate to be, I think, the 15th community nationwide that Cities for Financial Empowerment has selected to participate. And what it means is free counseling, financial counseling to anyone, any resident in the city of Syracuse. No, there's no other barrier. And it does provide access to these other opportunities. Many of our folks, part of the barriers when you're in poverty, you get charged. If you don't have a checking account, you get charged every time you make a payment. There's sort of underground taxes on the poor based on not having access to quality financial products and services. So we hope that helps reduce a lot of these barriers, helps folks start saving accounts and connect them to other resources like homeownership or other sorts of financial help people meet their financial goals.
And as we look at the change, as the mayor was talking about in the shadow of 81, many of those individuals are probably at a place there, you know, the myth that you all have done a wonderful job of displacing is that they're working people are in the poverty level.
Right.
So many of the individuals in that footprint, in that shadow of 81, are actually going to work every day and are potentially in position to become homeowners. The Financial Empowerment Center will help them with their credit, and this is the time to start those conversations.
Let's finish up with this question about the perception of poverty, and this has two sides. The one side is, What is the perception of Syracuse now that it has shown up on some of these lists and we don't like the statistics that come out? I mean, it's just data. But are you seeing, Mayor, that it hurts that Syracuse is seen as an impoverished city, even though there's many examples of prosperity and companies doing well? Is it getting in our way?
It's important that we be honest with ourselves and that we acknowledge the challenges that we have. And the fact that we show up on these lists, it's not by accident. So we have a poverty problem here. What I try to do is to ensure balanced perspective. So we need to be realistic and honest with ourselves about that challenge, but also put it in a broader perspective. So number one, as we talked about earlier, there is investment happening in our community, and we should celebrate that. We should embrace that. I also try to make the point that poverty is not a city of Syracuse issue. Number one, it's certainly not unique to the city of Syracuse. There are other communities dealing with it. But just because you don't live in the arbitrary political boundaries that are the city of Syracuse, if you live in the suburbs, if you live in the region, you own this problem as much as we do. And the reasons why poverty is concentrated in the city, again, are not accidental. Some of them are for good reasons in terms of, you know, being proximate to services, but others are very intentional in terms of exclusionary zoning and other ways in which surrounding communities have done everything in their power to concentrate the poverty within the city. So while it's important to acknowledge it and be honest with ourselves about it, again, that context is important, and it's important that if we're going to work our way out of it, we as a community, as a region, need to acknowledge it, acknowledge our role in it, and to identify ways in which everyone can help help address it.
The other perception issue I just wanted to maybe finish up with is people's perception of those in poverty does suffer from stereotypes and stigma. How can we change that for the good so that people are maybe more willing to do just what we were just talking about, is to play a little bit more of a role in alleviating it?
I just want to remind people of two things. One, there is nobody on the face of the earth that wants to live in an impoverished state. It is not a designed or a conscious decision to do that. There are a lot of variables that lead to why people are in poverty. Some are in people's control, but most are not in their control. The second thing I want to remind people of is that behind every percentage, behind every statistic, is a human being who is living and breathing in conditions that you and I probably couldn't live a day through.
Mayor, to finish up, what's your level of optimism that we're moving in the right direction? We're not going to solve this tomorrow. There's no program that helps everyone because of all the different types of needs. What's your level of optimism that we're doing some things that will move the needle?
Yeah, well, for those that know me, they know that I'm a generally optimistic person, realistic at the same time, but I am hopeful, and I think we have reason to be hopeful. Again, when we look at the numbers, we see some reasons to be encouraged, whether it is the poverty rate, which is going down, albeit nowhere near where it needs to be, or the graduation rate in our schools going up. There are reasons to be hopeful. To Sharon's point, which was beautifully put, setting aside the numbers, when you look at the individuals and the lives and the stories, there are amazing stories and amazing people in our city that we see and hear about every day, and those give me hope. The people that I interact with, I just came from Corcoran High School this morning, where I met with some just amazing young high school students, and they give me hope. And I think, you know, when you look at the leadership in the community, I feel like there's an alignment of leadership. We understand what our challenges are, but there's a sincere desire both in the public sector and the private sector to address those challenges. So I am optimistic.
Do you think more than in the past? Do you think it's reached a little bit of an energy level that it hadn't had in the past, even though we had poverty before?
Yeah, I think we are in a moment. We have a window of opportunity now that probably won't last forever. But yes, when I look around again at the leadership in the public sector, in the private sector, in the nonprofit sector, I think we have a convergence of circumstances that puts us in a position to move the needle significantly. And that's what we're all working on every day to do.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This has been a special program of City Limits Talk on WAER Syracuse. We want to thank Mayor Ben Walsh for your time. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Chief Data Officer Sam Edelstein, thank you.
Thanks.
The Deputy Mayor Sharon Owens, thanks for taking part.
Thank you.
Neighborhood Business Development Commissioner Stephanie Pasquale, thanks.
Thank you.
And as you have heard, the issue of poverty is a complex one. No simple solution works to alleviate or address it. Yet you've also heard that the number of people in poverty is holding us back at a time when there are positive signs for the city's future. City Limits is our year-long project to offer some insight into the problem, the realities of poverty for those living with it, and those on the front lines trying to help. You can hear the work, some 35 separate programs and discussions, at citylimitsproject.org, and tune into WAER local news coverage ongoing as we continue to cover this critical issue. With WAER news reporter and host Katie Zolkowski, I'm News and Public Affairs Director Chris Bolt. Good night.
Thanks for listening to City Limits, a production of WAER Syracuse Public Media. Find more from this series at citylimitsproject.org and subscribe in Apple Podcasts for automatic delivery of new episodes.